You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Hello. Welcome to today's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I think both the congressman and I feel like this is a hard act to follow all those,
other folks. What was that? Right? Like.
I'm Marisa Lagos. I am a correspondent, politics correspondent for KQED here in San Francisco. I co-host Political Breakdown, a show that kind of seeks to get behind the policies and the headlines with newsmakers. So this is a great forum for me. I'm super excited to be in conversation with Congressman Joe Kennedy III. He represents Massachusetts District 4. He is 38 years old. 1 year older than me, I'll note. And he's actually been in office since 2012. In 7 years, he's been outspoken on many issues locally and nationally. He's a rising star in the Democratic Party, and he recently introduced Senator Elizabeth Warren as she made her 2020 presidential bid official. So we have a lot to talk about. Thanks for being here.
What's up? How are we doing?
You know, just a casual conversation in front
of
100 people.
I brought the Boston weather with me. You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know. This is pretty warm outside.
Fair enough. There was snow on the ground when I left on Sunday, St. Patrick's Day. There's snow on the ground, and I think the day before was 34 degrees and rain.
Yeah, we don't do that here.
No, you don't. So thanks for having me. I am thrilled to be here.
So there obviously is a ton of policy and political stuff to talk about, but I want to, since you are from so far away on the other side, talk a little bit about your personal life and biography. So you're a twin, to start.
Yep.
How's your brother feel about you being a congressman?
I've got a twin brother. We are pretty close, although he refers to the 8 minutes. He was born 8 minutes before I am, or I was. He refers to it as the greatest 8 minutes of his life.
But then you showed him up.
Every other moment for him ever since. So we went to high school together. We went to college together, actually, out here down in Palo Alto. And then he stuck around out here for a little bit. I bounced around back to the UN working on an economic development program just for kind of a couple of months as a more or less a glorified internship before I went off to the Peace Corps. Was in the Dominican Republic for about 2.5 years, which was, I think, without question for me, the most formative experience I've had over the course of my life. And there's not a day that goes by in Congress that I do not draw on that experience to some form or another. And then from there to law school, my experience in the Dominican Republic really helped me understand how important the law is to set the framework and structures of our society and what happens when not everybody believes in that pathway forward. And I wanted to learn more about how that works and how it doesn't. And so I went to law school and thought, great, I'll find out more about that in my property class, and didn't.
But you did have a professor that everybody might be familiar with.
I did. And I, so no matter what contribution I will ever make to society, one that I know is going to be lasting is that if you Google the word assumpsit, my picture comes up. Because that was the first question that Professor Elizabeth Warren asked me on our very first day in our very first class in the very first moment of law school, and I didn't get it right. And I didn't get the next 10 questions that she asked, one after the next, after the next, after the next, after the next. And as a good friend of mine who ended up being in my wedding wrote, it was the one time that you said anything throughout our 3 years of law school together that was noteworthy, because I wrote in big, bold letters atop my paper, get a dictionary.
But you still managed to impress your wife in that class, right?
Whether it was impress or pity, whatever happened. But yes, I found the girl in the back row that took such pity on me that I convinced her to be in our study group, and then convinced her years later, she would remind everybody for the better half of a decade to marry me. She grew up in Newport Beach, so she's down there right now with our two little kids, 1 and 3, enjoying frozen bananas and walks on the boardwalk as I am moving up and down the West Coast.
And not sleeping, as we were discussing backstage.
No, although with my 1 and 3-year-old, so the 3-hour time change is not always helpful. I will say last night, and I hope she's not watching, I slept great. I got a text from her this morning. She did not, so... Yeah. I will get back.
You'll pay her back, I'm sure.
I will get back home very late tonight, or with her very late tonight, after I go north and then south. And yes, they will be my duty when I get back. But I feel good this morning. So yeah.
So again, before we get to the hard stuff, I interviewed Mayor Pete Buttigieg a couple weeks ago. Very proud of myself that I can now say his name without stumbling over it, first of all.
So before we get to the hard stuff, you're going to compare me to a Rhodes Scholar combat vet.
Right. No, actually, what I want to ask you,
presidential candidate. Great.
He's 37, and he and I had a debate.
Thanks for reminding me. Yes, great. Okay.
Do you think you're a millennial? Do you think we're millennials?
So that's a great question. Thank you.
Because Mayor Pete does, and I kind of disagree. I'm going to take a position here for one.
This is gets to the core of an existential question that I wrestle with from not infrequently. I was born in October of 1980, and 1980 is essentially the dividing line for millennials. So it gives me, in true political fashion, the ability to claim the generation when I need to and disown them when I
have
to.
Right. I like that. Like, I do the same thing.
There's a fence, and I'm firmly planted on both sides, right? Which I think... I think, joking aside, it does... being born at what is, in some sense, an inflection point of this kind of bridge between generations of our Americans is helpful to try to understand some of those tensions that are affecting millennials, although I am obviously on the upper end of that, and the generation that's coming after. Yeah. With kind of an understanding from an instruction from my parents about what society and life was like for them. And candidly, I'm sure we'll get into more of this, but the rules of the road that applied for Gen Xers and obviously baby boomers and my parents' generation just do not apply. The structures of society do not apply to millennials and the generation that comes next. So the panels, one of the panels that you mentioned, it is an area of focus of mine, candidly informed by my wife's work. She was a healthcare policy expert that ended up leaving her job and focusing solely on, founded a nonprofit on trying to make affordable, accessible, universal childcare a thing for this country. And if you look across society as that has changed, and the expectation now, if you want to have a family, is that both parents are going to work. The average cost of childcare in Massachusetts from 0 to 5, birth to 5, so before you get up in kindergarten, statewide, not just Boston, is $17,000 per child per year. Mm-hmm. It is more than tuition at the University of Massachusetts, for which you have 18 years to plan and college savings plans.
And the ability to take loans if you need to and other things, which probably don't want to do for a nanny.
You get, you know, most folks, maybe 9 months to figure out, hey, what are we going to do?
Right.
Right. And so the structures of our society at this point, and I think you're seeing the consequence of this play out in a wide variety of different ways, but play out across our country economically, culturally, and politically in some of the debates that you're getting on the right and on the left.
Right. Well, you've sort of deemed this as moral capitalism. You wrote an op-ed recently, and I pulled one quote. "We subject the poor to endless tests of character for our taxes to cover their next hot meal, but the rich face no such scrutiny when our taxes float their stock prices." Talk about what you mean by moral capitalism and sort of, I thought that line kind of summed up some of the distinctions you were making in that piece.
So, thanks. I think the broader picture here, from my perspective, is I don't think we as a society, from a political standpoint, Democrats or Republicans, have figured out how to adequately talk about, discuss, and address the systemic changes and fissures that we're seeing in our economy. And for a long time, the way that politicians, Democratic politicians, talked about an economy is, look, you work hard, you play by the rules, you should be able to get ahead. Well, that is just emphatically not true anymore. And the left's response, which is not wholly fair because it does more than this, but its response largely gets characterized as redistribution. Right? You got to tax the rich and redistribute that money and make investments, which, yes, we have to do, and we have to do more of that. But redistribution alone doesn't get to what I think is the central core of this issue, which is, as I traveled around the country to about 18 or 20 states, nearly 20 states last cycle, from West Virginia to Indiana to Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas, Arizona, and others, this feeling for so many that they are doing everything they can, and their head hits the pillow at night, and they are exhausted, and they are scared, and they are uncertain about what tomorrow might bring. And taking half of Jeff Bezos's fortune away and building more roads and bridges, yes, we need to do, and investing that in education, yes, we need to do. But it doesn't mean that a worker at an Amazon distribution facility has any greater retirement security if you do that. The core of this is an economic empowerment issue. It's trying to ensure that our system is recalibrated to allow American workers, American families to take ownership over their own futures. And that is hard and complex. You were nice to reference that op-ed. That op-ed was like 2,500 words, not 400 words.
Right.
Because the way in which that I think this playing field has been tilted from non-competes and no-poach clauses if you are working at a fast food restaurant to the misclassification of workers from an employer-employee relationship to independent contractors where you lose healthcare and retirement security to issues around antitrust, to issues around a lack of affordability of childcare, and to issues around enforcement on wage and hour law. So this is big and this is deep and this is complex and complicated, which on the one hand makes it ripe for Democratic policy. On the other hand, everybody says, okay, how do you put that on the bumper sticker? And I said, well, you can take my 2,500 words and shrink the font real small and probably get it there, right?
Well, but not just the bumper sticker, but I mean, what does that practically mean? Like at a fundamental level, you've hit on a wide range of sort of things that have happened over time, right? None of that happened overnight.
Right. And so... None of that happened overnight. I think that's an important piece to this discussion. This has been, to an extent, the frog boiling in water, right? This we're seeing the consequence, and not just of a one-off, right? None of those issues that I articulated in of themselves might be as devastating as the whole series of them are on top of each other. I get the question all the time, wherever I got, I'm bouncing around the West Coast this week. You know, what's going on? How's the economy? What do you think of the economy's doing? What are people talking about? And there's two real answers to that question. I'll give you the concrete example. I represent Fall River, Massachusetts, which is a post-industrial manufacturing town in the southern region of the state. Median household income there is about $35,000 to $40,000 household. There's a factory there that has been there since the 1970s for a company that has been recently spun off, an international company called Philips Lighting. In 2017, Philips Lighting, as a global corporation, made about $340 million in global profits. There's 160 employees at that plant. 100 of them are unionized. The city of Fall River and the state of Massachusetts have, over the years, made investments to help keep that plant competitive. Not huge ones, but sizable ones. After the Republicans passed their stock, their tax bill, Philips Lighting bought back $180 million in stock. They fired all 160 employees at that plant and sent the jobs to Mexico. So when you ask the question, how's the economy going? How's it doing? For the CEOs of Philips Lighting, it's going great. For the shareholders of Philips Lighting, it's going great. But for the 50% of Americans that don't own any stock, it's not doing so well. For the employees that worked at that factory, some of them literally for decades, it's devastating. And what I tried to articulate in the op-ed is just a series of questions around why is it okay if you're working at McDonald's that when you sign an employment contract, you sign away a non-compete. Mm-hmm. And not every McDonald's and not to just single them out. It's not just them. But why is it the companies are able to reclassify workers to get out of those employment responsibilities? Why is it that you have a tax code now that has put on even more incentives to aggregate wealth to shareholders rather than the workers that actually help grow it to begin with? Why is it that it is okay for this administration to try to put work requirements on Medicaid as they continue to try to do? The Secretary of Health and Human Services was before our committee last week. I asked him for a single study that showed that work requirements make people healthier. Guess what? There isn't one. Arkansas is trying to implement work requirements across in their state. 18,000 people have lost healthcare. I asked them if he knew why. They don't know. You know what they're trying to do? Roll out that policy to every other state across the country, putting 4 million people's access to healthcare at risk with no understanding or data as to why, what is actually happening and whether it's a bureaucratic hurdle which is causing people to lose healthcare or not. And guess what? It is. Why, if you are in public housing and you get arrested and convicted of marijuana possession, you can lose your house? But you can have a lengthy record of felony convictions and you still get a very generous tax credit for a private jet. True.
Yeah.
we laugh about that, but true. And so if our tax code is supposed to be a reflection of the type of behavior we want to incentivize in this country, why would we incentivize that? And what does that say about the ability for aspiring middle-class families, folks that are working so hard, that are struggling to try to find a way to get their kids to college to be able to afford to pay rent? How do we make that work? Last piece on this. And sorry for the rant, but I get fired up about it.
Making my job easy.
So, like Boston, like San Francisco, Boston has undergone a pretty dramatic change over the course of the past 10 years. We've got won a whole bunch of World Series. We've got a whole bunch of NFL championships. We got, a whole bunch of...
But you don't have the Warriors.
I had to. You got the Warriors. Right. So, there's been a building boom and an economic boom in Boston that rivals almost anywhere else in the country.
And a lot of tech, right?
Perhaps, and a lot of tech. Perhaps anywhere else, perhaps, except for here, right? But it's pretty darn close. The average net worth, stat came out last summer, the average net worth of a white household in Boston, Massachusetts, after 10 years of economic expansion, was about $250,000, household net worth. Any idea what it was for an African-American family? 35? Lower. 15? Lower. $8. $8. $8. After 10 years of economic expansion. If you could afford to put down a down payment on a condo 10 years ago, you have done fabulously well. If you couldn't, then whatever increase in wages you're seeing, which lagged, but essentially going right out the door on an increased rent bill every month. After 10 years of economic expansion, that economic growth we are seeing is not being absorbed by every American family. And that's the story that we also need to tell. That is the structural adjustment that we need to make, because that, you see the consequences of this clearly in a debate on immigration. You see it in a debate on healthcare. You see it in the questions about how do we find a way to make these pieces fit so that a younger generation of American families can actually afford to exhale at some point during the course of their day and their working life.
I think everything you're talking about probably sounds pretty good to this room in San Francisco, but one of the things we've seen in recent years is Republicans led by Donald Trump be really good at pitting people against each other, at sort of poo-pooing some of these conversations, like when they talk about reparations. I'm sure you've seen some of... And what it strikes me is that a lot of what you're talking about is buying into the concept of a common good, right? This idea that a rising tide does lift all boats and that we have a moral obligation to our neighbors. And I think it's really easy to say that, but when it comes down to brass tacks, like a lot of people kind of go the other way. Look at the college admissions scandal, mm-hmm. right? You may believe in public education, but when it's up to your kid, you want the best for them. Mm-hmm. Look at, gun control in this country and the difference between how we've reacted to New Zealand. This is a hard question, but how do you think folks on your side of the aisle try to sort of win those hearts and minds of people you're talking about who may have lost their jobs and are scared? And it's easier sometimes to retreat to fear than it is to say, let's all try to, band together and do this.
It's a great question. And
to solve the world problems right here.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. It's a great question. It's the challenge of our time. But I also think we can do this because our country's history is that we have done this before, and I've got an awful lot of faith we can do this again if you get the type of leaders, not just in elected office, but around our society, pointing this out, calling it out, and then urging a couple of steps forward. So a couple of examples on this. What you alluded to is how I believe President Trump has conducted his presidency, which is essentially creating this political allegiance between those that have at the very top who want deregulation and lower taxes so they can get more, and folks at the bottom that feel like their own economic station is eroding. And then pitting against folks that are struggling and are striving against each other over the scraps of a system while those that have walk away with everything else. And the fundamental question is, then it's on, I think, those of us that care about this, to be able to convincingly ask the question, why are you competing over scraps of the system rather than questioning a system that deems you of worthy only of scraps to begin with? And The trick there is then to make that case to those disparate populations across a big, wide country that see the manifestation of that erosion of worker power in perhaps very different ways. But the story that I told you about Philips Lighting is not all that different than the ones you've heard at GM plants or Carrier plants across the Midwest. Stock prices up, jobs down, gutted and gone. The Fair Labor Standards Act that helps govern the enforcement of wages through vast amounts of our society, some of you probably know there's carve-outs and exceptions to those to the protections in that bill. Farm workers are carved out. Domestic workers are carved out. But think of that for a second, where a domestic worker, and look, to be fair, state law has filled the gaps in some of these, but not unreasonable to, just for the sake of an argument here, see if you've got a farm worker in Delano or in Immokalee, Florida, that is picking strawberries, tomatoes, or anything else that is not subject to the waiver to the protections of the Fair Labor Standards Act, wonder how it is that they can get ahead. Well, they are subject to the exact same lack of protections that a domestic worker, a single mom in Roxbury, Massachusetts, trying to make things float with two little kids. It's the same lack of protections because it's carved out of the exact same darn bill. And so it is on, I think, look, this is a complex argument, again, one that I can't, I haven't figured out how to put in a bumper sticker yet. But it is at the core of saying the challenges that are confronting working and aspiring middle-class families across this country, they are subject to the same erosion of worker protection, worker empowerment that enables them to take ownership of their own future and feel like they can. It's manifested perhaps differently, but it comes from a same series of root causes and incentives from our labor laws to our tax code, to our healthcare system, and it is on us to help draw those connections out because I think they're there.
Let's get into some of these policies, but first, like a question about sort of the political will there. I mean, imagine a world, say, even where Hillary Clinton had won and, you know, Democrats had taken both houses of Congress. It's not as if Democrats are immune to corporate influence and lobbying. It's not as if a lot of these issues don't exist in states like California, when you talk about inequality, which is deep, deep blue right now. So how, like, I don't know, what do you think, having been in Congress, what, for six years now? Do you feel like those conversations are changing among your colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle? And if not, what would change them, do you think?
So look, I think they are changing. And I think our country is also reflective of, for an awful lot of reasons, I wonder what historians will write about this period 50 years from now. And I hope it'll be a chapter, not a tome. But we are at a point of economic, political, and cultural inflection and transition. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You can see that in the base of the political parties moving. You can see that economically. You can see that in a whole bunch of shifts. And of course, you're right. Democrats and the Democratic Party is subject to the same structures of our political system. Those structures and those interests are probably different ones than are as that respond to a Republican dominated House, Senate, and presidency. But I would say we just went through a major test back in November and the months up to November about kind of where we stand as a country. And we elected in a historic election a wave of Democrats, despite a still gerrymandered U.S. House of Representatives. Democrats won in the House, won 10 million more votes than our Republican colleagues, running on an awful lot of these issues to say, hey, in my mind anyway, we're not against prosperity in this country, we're not against success. We want people to succeed, of course we do. But we also believe that your success doesn't and shouldn't impede success of the person sitting to your right or your left. And the rising tide of lifting all boats, I believe in that, but I have to recognize that it doesn't necessarily lift all boats equally. And it's on us to make that case of saying, hey, there are major structural challenges that we have to address to make sure that people believe that if they are working hard today, that will pay off for them and their families tomorrow. And it is issues like a college admission scandal that just gut that idea. Because you sit there and say, no matter what I do, somebody else is going to find a side door. But that's why our system now has a chance to show that we're not going to allow that side door to happen. And when we find it, we'll close it.
Maybe like a mandatory Peace Corps for everybody so they have that revelation. I mean, cause, no, because that was one of the things I was, you know, reading up, and that you talked about, like, this sort of sense of being in the Dominican Republic and feeling like I'm not any smarter than the people around me necessarily. I didn't do anything more. I just had more resources and support. You know, one sort of concrete way that Democrats are starting to formulate some of these conversations is the Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. I know you're a co-sponsor. Mm-hmm. Republicans seem to sort of gleefully seize on this as their way. You know, Mitch McConnell has talked about taking this vote and forcing senators to go on the record.
You mean to tell me Mitch McConnell's being cynical about a Democratic bill?
I know. It's surprising.
I'm stunned.
I talked to Senator Amy Klobuchar this week, and she said, bring it on. but, you know, I think you've seen, we're starting to see what Trump's playbook will be around this and other issues, this charges of socialism. There's not going to be any cows anymore. You won't be able to ride in an airplane.
That's actually, so let's be clear before I say this. That allegation, one, is not true, but it is repeatedly made. Some of my closest friends in Congress are Republicans, and one of them like sat me down over dinner the other night and was like, listen, I know you co-sponsored this thing, but like, this is a socialist plot to take over America. And I was like,
did he read it?
Where? Oh yeah. He goes, look, this isn't going to happen overnight, but this is going to be used to deem cows a health hazard so you can eradicate them, and farms a health hazard so you can take that. You're going to like buildings. You're going to have updated building codes. You're going to seize those by eminent domain, and you're going to own all means of food production. Your government's going to have all housing and, you know, break out the hammer and sickle. I was like, I missed that part. There must be like a page 9 that you have that I didn't.
I went back and read it recently because I was like, what does this thing actually say? It's a statement of sort of
goals. Yeah, it doesn't
goals,
say that.
Right?
No.
Well, so what'd you say back to him, I guess, to start?
I'm not so sure I can repeat that.
This is a family show, yeah.
Yeah, right. So, with candidly, he's a good friend, and he was with another Republican colleague of mine. I kind of looked at my other Republican buddy, he was like, what? And he was like, yeah, that's not what it says. But anyway, you want to be against it, you can be against
it. How do you want to frame it, though? Like, so what is the way the Democrats...
Here's what the Green New Deal says. And one, I would encourage all of you to read it. It's like, I think it's 8 pages
long. It's really short.
9 pages long. It's not it is not a heavy lift. So here's essentially what the bill really says. It says, one, we have an economy that does not work for everybody that is going to require government restructuring in terms of incentives, taxes, et cetera, in order to empower it to actually work for everybody. I agree. It says climate change is real. I agree. It says that in order to meet the challenges of climate change, we need to address that structural inequity in our economy to address and use that to address climate change. Because as you empower more and more people, let's put them to work to address climate change, because we need all the help we can get with climate change. And then it says, as we do so, here's the goals that we should seek to address. Everybody should have access to clean air. I agree. Everybody should have access to clean drinking water. I agree. Everybody should have access to a good job that provides you to be able to provide somebody to have to meet the basic needs of your family and have a little bit of vacation and paid family leave. I agree. It says that everybody should have access to housing and education, et cetera, which there is not a single piece here that I think any of you in this room, and candidly, most of my Republican colleagues, would disagree with. It sets out goals that are goals. What it does not do is say, how are we going to get there? You know what they're asking for? A year with a select committee, people that want to work on this, with some staff resources to figure out how we're going to get there. That's kind of what Congress is supposed to do. Take some big, bold idea, be like, hey, this is what we should, let's aim high, and let's figure out what we are going to get out of this and what we're going to ask the American public to contribute in order to do so. And then we can have a debate about it. There's nothing in there about like taking away hamburger or abolishing an airline industry.
Yeah. Congressman T.J. Cox told me yesterday that if the cows just eat some kelp, apparently this is a new thing to... He's from the Central Valley, so he's. I mean, how would you grade though the Democrats on how well they're doing in terms of articulating what you're talking about? Because it seems like this is another area where it's taken a little bit for the left to sort of catch up, and meanwhile, like Trump and McConnell have been kind of running with the ball.
So let's be clear about a couple things. One, Democrats aspire to be, we just ran on, the idea that we want to be a party that is reflective of the diversity of our country, that we want a big tent, that we invite everybody from all walks of life in, that we engage in that discussion, we engage in that debate, we see you, we value you for who you are, for the ideas that you bring, your background, your experiences, your history, your religion, your sexual identity, your gender, everything. And let's have that discussion because our country has got your back and we see you, we hear you, we value you. Great. Those are the values we just ran on and we won. And we won big. And then all of a sudden you get this incredible freshman class that ends up meaning that the Democratic caucus is a majority-minority caucus when you include sexual identity and sexual orientation, which is an amazing thing. And then after you have all these voices with all these different backgrounds from every corner of the country, you sit there and go, how come we can't agree on something? Because we just elected people that we said we weren't going to agree on everything, and that was okay.
Right.
Like, 100%. So the piece, though, you bring up a good point, right, is we are going to disagree on some of the policy implementation about this. The part that I think every Democrat would probably agree with the things that I just articulated about a Green New Deal. Economy doesn't work for everybody. Climate change is real. Let's address it, and I hope that we can solve all these big problems. Why not? Sure, let's figure it out. One. Two. Healthcare. Going to be a big debate about healthcare, not just in this presidential campaign, but across our country. We need to have it. We should have it. There are real differences between a single payer system. However that is constructed at this point drawn up, and a public option, Medicare for All, Medicare for America, Medicaid buy-in, strengthening and supporting the ACA, all of that. Those are all important bills. They're all important topics. They have trade-offs that have to be discussed with the American public. The underlying value through every one of those bills is that Democrats believe in this country, you get health care that you need when you need it at a price you can afford, period. The Republican idea is taking health care away from 30 million people is in fact a good thing for the federal government. It is an okay thing for the federal government to do, and they clinked champagne glasses at the White House when they did it. That it is okay to institute work requirements that have shown zero evidence, as I said, to make people healthier, and to put up bureaucratic hurdles to say, you know what, in this country, you have to earn it and deem yourself worthy in order to get there. That is their vision of the federal government's role in healthcare. That could not be further away from a Democratic vision. You will hear media ask real questions about the differences between those bills. There's differences, and we should flush those out. But the underlying value, there is not a Democrat that I have met that disagrees with that value. And Republicans are then going to start targeting the different plans. Right. What's your plan? Taking healthcare away from 30 million people is a good idea. Okay, well, if that's what you still believe, let's run on that, because bang up job, it worked for you last time.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
This is kind of a softball, but like, how much do you blame people? People, how much do you blame people in my job for this? Because I do think that there's a narrative of like the civil war in the Democratic Party, and I can't really remember if we had the same narrative around the Tea Party and like what was happening on the right. But it does seem like there's some framing of this that goes beyond the very personal and visceral attacks on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that I've seen Republicans make. I mean, it's like...
So, yeah. A couple things. First, to some of our new colleagues. One, obviously, you learn in this job pretty quickly. If you're going to put yourself out there and put out big ideas and come up with big, bold theories or policies, like, they're going to get vetted and they're going to get...
I mean, I think she kind of enjoys it, actually. She seems to be handling it pretty well.
Yeah, well, so one... She handles herself just fine. Yeah. Thank you very much. Right? Like,
yeah, I'm not shedding any tears over here for AOC.
No, she can pack a punch, and she doesn't need anybody else to defend her because she's doing just fine on her own. And anybody that wants to tangle with her will figure that out
and they'll live stream it so we can all watch it. Yeah,
about as eviscerating on Twitter as anybody else I've ever seen. Right? So she's doing she's good at this, and I welcome her into our caucus, and she's a great voice for our caucus. Two, as you put forth those ideas and policies and proposals, you are going to get critiqued and you got to be ready to defend them. And not everybody gets it right every single piece of the time. And that's fine. That's part of the vetting process. Three, obviously, that when it comes to her specifically, the way that some, not even necessarily on the right, but some have attacked her personally and it literally have just been disgusting. So like that needs to stop. And I think some of my Republican colleagues would agree with it, right? That there's just a line there that has been crossed a number of times that is just inexcusable. But four, look, I do think that there's, as we get back to in this, the fact that you run on the idea of having a big, open, and diverse tent, the fact that you elect people that represent that, and then that they try to give voice to those ideas, and then you sit there and go, hey, how come you're not going to get in line? Because like, we were just elected not to get in line. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's also a part of this of saying, look, you're running a campaign. That campaign, on the one hand, is an individual thing. You're running to get yourself elected, and now you're part of a team. And so we all want to row together, and let's make sure we're rowing in the same direction. We might have different ideas about how, again, those values are manifested, but we agree on those values. But I don't think that there's anywhere near the difference amongst the values that are exhibited in a Democratic caucus at the moment and the destructive nature that a Tea Party caucus did to a Republican Party and Republican governance. And candidly, we got to a point there for a while when I was my first several years here, where it was less than 10% of the entire House of Representatives dictated the entire policy for the House of Representatives and for government, because if you didn't get the Freedom Caucus's buy-in, you couldn't pass a bill.
Right.
And I think they're also seeing the consequence of that, because that sounds great in theory, and then when the American public catches up, you kind of go, well, we didn't, that might cater to a 10% of our society, but there's 90% of the rest of us that are like, hey, you know, let's actually address these concerns rather than just demagogue about them.
Yeah. But I know that you know, especially early on, have really prided yourself on working across the aisle when you can. I think that, you know, there's a lot of conversation around civility. But it strikes me that if Democrats are successful in 2020 and can keep the House, you know, the Senate is a much harder path. And as you sort of alluded to earlier, Mitch McConnell is very good at his job. And I just wonder, like, is it sort of Pollyanna-ish to think that somebody like him and the sort of way he has run the Senate will ever come along, regardless of who's in the White House? I mean, look at what happened to Merrick Garland. You know, I wonder if bipartisanship is truly possible with the current generation of leaders we have in specifically the Senate.
Man, I hope so. Right. Yeah. And look, it saddens me immensely. And I think you end up in the circumstance where you have, where you look at your political moment as a chance to beat the other side without ever thinking what you're trying to do is beat a fellow American, and like, it's their country too. And they live here too. And we should seek to, if the greatest deliberative body in the world, apparently the U.S. Senate, seeks to actually represent the United States, then like those voices should matter as well. I am particularly cognizant of a story actually that an experience that I had when I first got elected to Congress. So I get sworn in January of 2013, and a couple of weeks later, I asked my chief of staff. I just said, you know what, I've met Speaker Boehner. We, you know, you like do the quick photo op and hand on the Bible and sworn in thing. Great. But like, I, you know, at some point, I just actually like to meet him and like introduce myself, because you barely got a chance to do that. And so he said he'd reach out. And to Speaker Boehner's credit, 24 hours later, I was in his office. It's his office in the Capitol, and I'm in this hold room, and a bunch of people come out and I get ushered in, and it's a much nicer office than I had. and I walk in and there's a bunch of people there, because there's a bunch of chairs set up in a circle. And he sits me and he says, grab a seat. So I sit down, and he is in a chair probably about as far away as the second row, like an awkwardly long distance away. And I don't quite know what to do.
Is that like a power move?
I just like, who knows? He sits like he sits down for a quick second and then he gets up and he starts walking around the circle that way. And I'm like, I'm lost. Like I, you know, and he comes back over and he goes to a little side table over here and pulls out a tumbler and fills it up to the top with red wine, takes out a pack of smokes, lights up, and then goes on a rant from there, which was amazing. I will, like this is exactly what I was hoping for. Oh my God, this is great, right? He couldn't have been nicer. And at the end of it, he was kind of, he said, so two quick things about it. He said, one, I bet you're wondering why you're here. And I was like, well, candidly, yeah. And he said, when he was a freshman legislator in the Ohio State House, he'd done the exact same thing, got elected and asked to meet with the speaker at some point. It didn't have to be urgent. And like 6 months later, the assistant called up and said, the speaker's gonna be walking from office A to office B. You can walk with him and get your 5 minutes. And Speaker Boehner said, forget it. But he said, if he was ever in a position where he was the leader of a legislative body and a member asked for 5 minutes, he'd find a time for 5 minutes. He's like, so you got your 5 minutes. So we chatted for a couple more minutes, and then I asked him for his advice. And this gets back to your question. He said, essentially, paraphrasing a bit, but he said, there is always another round. Your ally today can be your adversary tomorrow and your ally the next. The number of issues, the complexity, the diversity of them that come across our desk, there are just too many of them and they come too fast and too often. Work hard. Be polite. Don't take it personally. That last one's pretty hard to do. But the point that there is always another round in this business. No Congress can ever bind another Congress on any piece of legislation. We write the laws, you rewrite the laws. What works today obviously does not necessarily mean it will work in 5 years or 10 years. You can roll somebody today, but at some point, that person will have a chance to roll you later. And if you don't think they will, their staff will. Somebody will. And so it ends up being extremely short-sighted, I think, to kind of get into the zero-sum definition of political success, because all that that ends up meaning is that when you can, if you can, you will, because somebody else did. And look, it's hard for somebody that has been essentially, we're finally a majority. If you want to pass a bill, I still got to get through President Trump and Mitch McConnell. It would be extremely tempting to be able to hopefully have a Democratic House, Senate, and presidency. Okay, fine, just put forth an entire Democratic agenda. And I would love to do that. I'm also conscious of the fact that the undercurrent for so much of the tension and uncertainty and fear across the country on the left and the right is the concern that the other side is driving their ideological agenda down your throat. And I feel this every day back home in Boston where, unlike here, you look at what's coming out of policies from the White House or cabinet agencies or Republicans in the Senate and say, this is just antithetical to so much of what Boston or Massachusetts believes in. Just chill for a second and listen to our concerns. And it's hard for me to sit there and say, hey, just do that. And then know that if the circumstances flip, do I want to do the exact same thing to other Americans that are fearful of, that interpret these issues a bit differently? And I think it's just something we got to keep in mind and be respectful of.
I want to get to 2020 in a second. We got a lot of questions about that. But one issue that you've really taken on that, you know, not everybody in the Democratic Party is talking about is LGBT rights and specifically transgender rights. I know your roommate in Stanford was Jason Collins, former NBA player who really made history when he came out as gay.
His brother's the coach over at Golden State. Yeah.
I just wonder if that personal relationship like has helped influence sort of your passion on this issue. And also like how crazy is that to have the two of you guys be Stanford roommates and now, you know, kind of where you've gone.
Yeah, we don't get confused for each other very often.
No. I guess it's like, you're tall, though. Yeah.
I ain't 7 feet, right? I mean, you know. So first off, Jason was, I saw him earlier this week. He's a great guy. He's a good friend. And he told me he was he came out to me shortly before the piece came out in Sports Illustrated, where he came out. And it took me a little while to understand what he was actually saying. I was like, huh? What? Oh, great. I think it was, for that moment, at least for me, I thought it was so emblematic of Jason, where he wasn't looking to, for a guy that was not looking to make news or looking to make waves, but I think finally felt the responsibility that somebody had to step forward and say that this is who I am and it is okay and I'm willing to take the heat from it, but like somebody's got to go first, and so I will.
Yeah, he did.
And I'm incredibly proud that he did. He's a good man, a good friend. And look, the issues with...
Well, specifically, I think, I mean, right now, one of the big issues is transgender in the military. And I think there's sort of a court order at this point.
There's a court order at this point. I just got notice, I think, last night, a resolution that I offered, which has about the support of over 190 Democrats, will be on the floor next week.
Right.
Telling the president that is a ban, is a very bad idea. And it's a very bad idea for a wide variety of reasons, but I think, folks, like from my perspective on this, and yeah, having good friends that are members of the LGBT community is obviously helps get you comfortable with a community that you might not otherwise have a whole lot of contact with, although being out here and being in Boston, I probably had more than a lot of other folks. But... If you ever walk out of the House of Representatives or the Senate, so directly across the plaza from the House is the Library of Congress. The building to the left is the Supreme Court. And etched in stone, above the doors of the Supreme Court says equal justice under law. And you think back to the founding documents of our country that some truths are self-evident and that all men are created equal, and you recognize that when we said... Our brilliant forefather said all men, they meant rich, white, Protestant men, and that's it. But the ensuing 200 plus years has been a journey, a quest, a fight to actually expand on that definition of men, to try to include everybody. And as a federal lawmaker today, as a straight, white guy, I walk out of the House of Representatives and I can see that building, and you can't quite make out the words, but I know that they're there. And I know that from the federal government of the most powerful country on earth, the protections they offer me are not the same protections they offer Jason, and are not the same protections they offer anybody in the trans community. And when it comes to a trans military ban, think of what that, and I'm sure you have, but think of what that says for a moment for the members of our military trans community that are fighting overseas right now that woke up and found out on Twitter that their president says, their commander-in-chief says, you are not worthy to serve. That the sacrifice that you are willing to make to put your life on the line, your commander deems it unworthy of your service. That it's literally not worth it. That we don't want you here. And I can't think of anything more fundamentally contrary to our values than that. And for our colleagues, conservatives, that will throw around these words about liberty and freedom, if the most powerful democracy on the planet cannot guarantee the freedom to its citizens to be true to who they really are, to live one's true life and true self, then I don't care what else you say, that word rings awfully hollow. And that's what this ban is about. And that's what this resolution is about, is saying this isn't about a tweet. This is about a fundamental core value for which this country was founded and for what so many people have fought for, to try to make sure that you are seen and you are heard and that you count and that your government has got your back. And I have no doubt that that bill is going to pass, that resolution is going to pass. I expect it will have some Republican support. And I hope that will inspire some of our conservative colleagues to... in the Senate, to take a good, hard look. There's not all that many times, I think, in this business that you actually have a chance to know in the long run what history is going to say on an issue. But I have a pretty good idea of what history is going to say about this one. And you can be on the right side of it, or you can be on the wrong side of it. You got a chance to be on the right side of it early. I hope they make that choice.
You know, you mentioned our founding fathers, and one issue, two issues really, and we got a couple of questions about this, that some of the presidential, 500 presidential candidates have been talking about, are, one, changing the Electoral College, or abolishing it, mm-hmm. And two, this idea of court packing, which I find to be a sort of weird term, but the idea of expanding the Supreme Court to have more justices. What are your thoughts on that?
Done with the softballs, apparently.
Yeah, right. There's this lightning round, last 15 minutes.
Right, yes or no, right. Fundamental issues of our democracy, yes or no, agree or not. With regards to the Electoral College, we'll start there. I share people's frustration with the Electoral College. Democrats have won, I think, the popular vote of the last six out of the last seven elections, and we've lost a couple of them, right? And so if you stand firm on the idea that every vote counts,
right,
not every vote seems to, and it sure seems like we need to update that system. I'm open to that debate. I'm not quite sure I'm wholly sold that the right way to solve that problem is abolishing the Electoral College. I'm open to it at this point, but I still want to make sure that, again, getting back to something I said earlier, that there is this kind of push and pull between a concern for rural America that their voices aren't being heard,
yeah,
that we have Democrats that are also cognizant of that and are willing to run hard for those communities. And I want to make sure that I just got to think it through a little bit more as to, if you abolish that, does it just mean that you have candidates that run to the biggest and most populous cities and aren't willing to take those voices for granted, or overlook those voices and decide not to hear them? And I don't know exactly how that pans out. I'm still wrestling with it a bit, but I think going back to the vestiges of an electoral college that was based off of, in some part, of the vestiges of slavery to try to come up with a compromise that clearly is not reflective of the overall will of the people, I think it becomes increasingly hard to defend that system. Yeah. One.
It's also interesting to me that people like Mayor Pete are bringing this up when they're from states like Indiana, you know, because it does seem like something that is maybe a little bit more, a harder argument to make if you're a Kamala Harris, right, than if you're representing a state that maybe would have a different impact if, you know, California would stand to gain a lot in a non-electoral college system. Mm-hmm. Indiana, maybe not so much. Like, is there political danger here, I guess, is the question.
I think there's... I think the larger question, rather than political danger, is... to take the hokey and romantic, yet from somebody that's not running for president, still like ideal of the fact that the president of the United States governs everybody and that you want those voices, even the folks that don't vote for you or don't vote.
Right.
You want to make sure that those voices are at the very least taken into account as those policies and taken into account as you campaign. And the system clearly, as it is currently constructed, incentivizes campaigning in a small number of swing states. A new system probably incentivizes people to campaign in a perhaps larger number of big cities. And cities including Texas or Houston and San Antonio and Austin and places that Democrats at the moment don't spend in the general election a whole lot of time.
Yeah, as someone who's grown up in California, I would say, like, we're the piggy bank. We don't get any attention. You know, I mean, that probably will change next year because we're on Super Tuesday, but it's historically been people come to town, mm-hmm. get all the checks, and then they... you know, run to Iowa.
So
just saying,
wrestling with it. And I don't,
yeah.
I think appropriate diagnosis of the problem. I'm trying to figure out if that solution actually, if the abolition of the Electoral College solves that problem appropriately, and working on it. Court packing. So also a tough one. I think on the one hand, you can make a pretty darn good argument, and I would make that, Republicans already did, that not confirming Merrick Garland for a year was akin to swinging the outcome of the Supreme Court, right? And there's very little doubt about that. I also believe that, as a recovering lawyer, and as a lawmaker, that the kind of last, as you have political ideology that continues to infect our political system and our governance system, that having one system that is more immune from that, and it's hard to say that the Supreme Court and our federal court system is wholly immune from that, given what Mitch McConnell is doing, but trying to keep a semblance of legitimacy there, I think, is critically important. And so the idea, as brutal as this is, the idea that all of a sudden, if a Democrat's there, we're going to start packing the court, Republican wins the next time, they pack the court.
It's like an arms race.
And again, I'm not so sure that, you know, there's no constitutional limit on how many justices should stand there, which is why it's the easier solution is potentially saying pack the court. There's other ideas out there about term limits where you stagger the justices so that in all likelihood, assuming there's not an emergency or a death, that those justices, no president would presumably appoint more than two over the course of a term. I think it is worth exploring this. I do think that, again, the current circumstance on this, Mitch McConnell has, I think, done extraordinary damage to the legitimacy of that of the system, and one that needs to maintain. We need to maintain that integrity. So wrestling with that one too.
Yeah. So you opened Senator Elizabeth Warren's presidential nomination or presidential announcement. We've already covered that you were a student of hers, as was Katie Porter, representative from
and Tom Cotton.
Orange County. Wow.
Somebody, one of the three of us, didn't pay attention in
class. Why Warren? I mean, obviously, besides your personal relationship, I know you had waited for a while before.
So, personal relationship. So I've known her for years. Back when I was her student, it was their first year contracts class. I took bankruptcy, not because I loved bankruptcy, but 2 years later. But because she was such an incredible teacher, and she demanded so much out of her students, and she scared the crap out of all of her students because she was so demanding. But it was amazing to see her work, because she was that tough on students because she believed that we could be better, and she pushed us because she believed that you could, if pushed, you would respond. And I see part of that reflective in the way she's running this race. I see part of that reflective in the way that she was a senator, of saying, no, we're going to push our colleagues, we're going to push the American public, we're going to push this country to actually be the best version of itself, which is exactly what she did for her students, one. Two, when it comes to the structural issues that we talked about earlier in the conversation about the structural issues that I think are so critical to recalibrating an America that enables every family to succeed. She has done far more. She's way ahead of the rest of the other candidates at understanding that structural disempowerment and the various policies that I think need to be changed to restore that that opportunity to American families. I think she's doing great. So
yeah. A lot of questions I got about your future and whether you would consider being in a potential Democratic cabinet, potential VP spot.
Who knows?
Okay.
I mean, like, life is pretty full at the moment. My future is focused on essentially iterating between coffee and sleep, depending on what where we're at.
Yeah, how do you guys handle just like the logistics of two kids?
So the short answer to that is, like, we just don't. It is
That's like a very honest answer from a young dad, I gotta say.
Like, complete and total mess.
That's what I always tell people. They're like, how do you do it? I'm like, I don't know. When I figure it out, I'll let you know.
So, a little peek behind the curtain. So I was down in D.C. 6-8 weeks ago, stopping through New York on my way home, polar vortex, delayed flight. Taking out the trash is my responsibility, so I was going to get home very late. My wife was kind enough to take out the trash. You guys might not know this, but water freezes.
We're not that familiar, but yes, right, we've heard.
It gets cold, water freezes, which can form black ice, which on a driveway down a slope is not helpful, so broke her ankle in two places.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, which was a super big bummer. So she was non-weight-bearing for 5 weeks, which with a one-year-old and a three-year-old, and the one-year-old can't walk, is like an interesting little trick. So like total chaos for 5 straight weeks. She couldn't be alone in the house. If there was an emergency, whatever, she couldn't get out of the house with the kids. So all hands on deck, total mess and disaster. But we've made it through. She, it was nice. I'm going to get in trouble for this, but she, we were there with the doctor and he was like, you know, she can't change any diapers. And I was like, doc, like ankle bone, hand bone, how does this like...
Like anything? How, like how did she call ahead?
How did that? Like, how does that? My biology class, I apparently didn't study enough. But like, so she was like, "Hey, doctor said it." So she, so I am so glad to have her in a walking boot. Yes.
How do I get that injury? I mean,
don't. Yeah, just, it's not. It is not, not worth want, it. Yeah. It is not. It is not worth a broken ankle. But chaos is the short answer. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, going back to 2020. There's such a wide range of candidates. I would say for most folks, I think it's pretty exciting, but I think there's a lot of concern. And, you know, when I talk to people who are not steeped in this the way we are, I think a lot of voters are, you know, trying to get their heads around all these candidates. I mean, understanding that you've endorsed Warren, but how would you say that sort of normal people should be looking at and assessing this field? Because I think it's hard.
So I'd say a couple things. One, you heard me articulate why I think Senator Warren would make a great president. I think she's putting out the policies that are driving and need to drive this the intellectual side of this campaign and debate. So I'd urge you to take a look there. Two, if you think back to kind of the, I would argue, probably the three biggest stars of a 2018 election cycle, I think of them anyway, is Stacey Abrams, Andrew Gillum, and Beto O'Rourke. And I point out that as probably a year ago, most of you had never heard of any of those three. People got to play, right? This is about campaigns, at least in my mind, presidential campaigns are about answering a question that the electorate is asking. And what you're seeing at the moment is candidates trying to go out there and shape that question and go out and touch and talk to as many people as they can and try to get that feedback to be able to ask that question and come up with an answer for it. This is going to just play out. Most of you, to the extent that you heard of Mayor Pete, in the last month, probably hadn't heard of him before. Incredibly impressive, dynamic young man that is doing a great job and driving an important part of the discussion here too. But that's what happens when you have a vibrant, talented field that is going to go out there and lean into these challenges. So let them run. Mm-hmm. See what happens. You're going to have... I'm sure you have. There's a whole bunch of them. I assume you're invited every single one of them here. Come back. Ask them the questions. See how they respond. Yeah. See how they frame them. The issues that I've identified over the course of the last hour aren't going to be all that different from the ones they identify. We might talk about it differently. We'll think about them differently. See which one resonates with you. I don't think you have to be... this race. These races start earlier and earlier every cycle, but we are a long way away from casting ballots. Let this play out a bit. See who's got a finger on the pulse that is able to actually connect policy to an American voter and pull together the coalition we're going to need to beat an extremely formidable incumbent president.
It's going to be a fun year.
Wild.
All right. So we have an informed tradition. Our final question to all speakers is, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Don't break your ankle.
Yeah, right, don't break your ankle.
Call ahead for the doctor's visit, and my wife schooled me on that one. So I guess if I had to the single biggest thing I think our country could benefit from, and the world probably too, is a little bit of greater understanding and empathy of somebody that is just completely and totally different circumstances than we are. And I come from a community and a town and a city that has an awful lot in common with the places like London and Paris and San Francisco and Tokyo and Hong Kong, and probably more in common with some of them than parts of the rural Midwest. And my classmates from college and law school are probably more, and myself included, frequent some of those other cities more often than we do some of the other parts of our country. And so I think whether that's walking outside and, you know, having a chance to strike up a conversation with a stranger, or whether that's finding some reason or opportunity or just to learn about someplace new and engage somebody different and understand, not necessarily listening to a news station you don't traditionally listen to, because I've tried that and they last like 30 seconds and I can't handle it. But like trying to find a way to, at least I'll ask plenty of my Republican colleagues, just why? You think that government spends too much money on Medicaid, fine. You're okay with $1 trillion debt or deficits. Weird, but like, fine. But just like, help me understand why. Help me understand what it is, what you view, how you view this issue versus how I view this issue. And I will still stand pretty strong, and I whacked them on the Medicaid stuff a bunch of times here, and I feel pretty strongly about it. But it is also helpful to me to understand what it is when that issue comes up or another one, what is the underlying value they're actually trying to give voice to. And I think you see that, obviously, a political moment around our country. You see that happening internationally. You see that a British Parliament at the moment trying to understand what it is that their electorate actually wants. You see that with the rest of the EU trying to understand what it is a British Parliament wants. You see that with an influx in migration as the world struggles to address climate change. You see that in vacuums that are filled in geopolitics throughout the Middle East and Southeast Asia. And I think not that more empathy is going to solve all those problems, but it probably doesn't hurt.
All right. Got some homework. Senator Joe Kennedy, thank you. Oh, I give you a
promotion.
Congressman,
there you go.
Promotion.
How about that?
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman,
thank you
for joining us at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. And to our audience in the room and listening at home, I'm Marisa Lagos from KQED. Have a great day.
Thank you.